You're listening to From the Public Domain, stories and excerpts from the public domain. I'm your host, Susie Alphins. Today's selections will include part three of Colonel Starbottle for the Plaintiff by Bret Harte. And because April is National Poetry Month, we will have a few poems to wrap up this segment. Colonel Starbottle for the Plaintiff, Part 3. "I shall prove to you, gentlemen of the jury," said the colonel solemnly, drawing a Bible from his coat-tail pocket, "that the defendant, for the last 12 months, conducted an amatory correspondence with the plaintiff by means of underlined words of sacred writ and church psalmody, such as beloved, precious, and dearest, occasionally appropriating whole passages which seemed apposite to his tender passion. I shall call your attention to one of them. The defendant, while professing to be a total abstainer, a man who, in my own knowledge, has refused spirituous refreshment as an inordinate weakness of the flesh, with shameless hypocrisy, underscores with his pencil the following passage and presents it to the plaintiff. The gentleman of the jury will find it in the Song of Solomon, page 548, chapter 2, verse 5. After a pause in which the rapid rustling of leaves was heard in the jury box, Colonel Starbottle declaimed in a pleading, stentorian voice, "Stay with me, flagons, comfort me with the apples, for I am sick of love. Yes, gentlemen, yes, you may well turn from those accusing pages and look at the double-faced defendant. He desires to be stayed with flagons. I am not aware at present what kind of liquor is habitually dispensed at these meetings, and for which the defendant so urgently clamored, but it will be my duty before this trial is over to discover it, if I have to summon every barkeeper in this district. For the moment, I will simply call your attention to the quantity. It is not a single drink that the defendant asks for, not a glass of light and generous wine to be shared with his inamorata, but a number of flagons or vessels, each possibly holding a pint measure, for himself." The smile of the audience had become a laugh. The judge looked up warningly when his eye caught the fact that the colonel had again winced at this mirth. He regarded him seriously. Mr. Hotchkiss's counsel had joined in the laugh affectedly, but Hotchkiss himself was ashy pale. There was also a commotion in the jury box, a hurried turning over of leaves, and an excited discussion. "The gentleman of the jury," said the judge with official gravity, "will please keep order and attend only to the speeches of counsel. Any discussion here is irregular and premature, and must be reserved for the jury room after they have retired." The foreman of the jury struggled to his feet. He was a powerful man with a good-humored face, and in spite of his unfelicitous nickname of the Bone Breaker, had a kindly, simple, but somewhat emotional nature. Nevertheless, it appeared as if he were laboring under some powerful indignation. "Can we ask a question, Judge?" he said, respectfully, although his voice had the unmistakable Western American ring in it, as of one who was unconscious that he could be addressing any but his peers. "Yes," said the judge, good-humoredly. "We're finding in this year piece, out of which the colonel has just been a-quotin', some language that me and my partners allow hadn't ought to be read out afore a young lady in court, and we want to know of you, as a fair-minded and impartial man, if this is the regular kind of book given to gals and babies down at the meeting house." "The jury will please follow the counsel's speech without comment," said the judge, briefly, fully aware that the defendant's counsel would spring to his feet, as he did promptly.
The court will allow us to explain to the gentlemen that the language they seem to object to has been accepted by the best theologians for the last 1,000 years as being purely mystic. As I will explain later, those are merely symbols of the church.
Of what?
Interrupted the foreman in deep scorn.
Of the church. We ain't asking any questions of you, and we ain't taking any answers,
said the foreman, sitting down promptly.
I must insist, said the judge sternly, that the plaintiff's counsel be allowed to continue his opening without interruption. You,
to the defendant's counsel,
will have your opportunity to reply later.
The counsel sank down in his seat with a bitter conviction that the jury was manifestly against him and the case was as good as lost. But his face was scarcely as disturbed as his client's, who, in great agitation, had begun to argue with him wildly and was apparently pressing some point against the lawyer's vehement opposal. The colonel's murky eyes brightened as he still stood erect with his hand thrust in his breast.
It will be put to you, gentlemen, when the counsel on the other side refrains from mere interruption and confines himself to reply, that my unfortunate client has no action, no remedy at law, because there were no spoken words of endearment. But, gentlemen, it will depend upon you to say what are and what are not articulate expressions of love. We all know that among the lower animals, with whom you may possibly be called upon to classify the defendant, there are certain signals more or less harmonious, as the case may be. The ass brays, the horse neighs, the sheep bleats. The feathered denizens of the grove call to their mates in more musical roundelays. These are recognized facts, gentlemen, which you yourselves, as dwellers among nature in this beautiful land, are all cognizant of. They are facts that no one would deny, and we should have a poor opinion of the ass who, at such a supreme moment, would attempt to suggest that his call was unthinking and without significance. But, gentlemen, I shall prove to you that such was the foolish, self-convicting custom of the defendant, with the greatest reluctance and the greatest pain. I succeeded in wresting from the maidenly modesty of my fair client the innocent confession that the defendant had induced her to correspond with him in these methods. Picture to yourself, gentlemen, the lonely moonlight road beside the widow's humble cottage. It is a beautiful night, sanctified to the affections, and the innocent girl is leaning from her casement. Presently, there appears upon the road a slinking, stealthy figure, the defendant, on his way to church. True to the instruction she has received from him, her lips part in the musical utterance.
The colonel lowered his voice in a faint falsetto, presumably in fond imitation of his fair client.
Curry!
Instantly the knight became resonant with the impassioned reply.
The colonel here lifted his voice in stentorian tones.
Carow! Again, as he passes, rises the soft
Curry!
Again, as his form is lost in the distance, comes back the deep Carow.
A burst of laughter, long, loud, and irrepressible, struck the whole courtroom, and before the judge could lift his half-composed face and take his handkerchief from his mouth, a faint
Cree
from some unrecognized obscurity of the courtroom was followed by a loud
Crow
from some opposite locality.
The sheriff will clear the court,
said the judge sternly. But alas, as the embarrassed and choking officials rushed hither and thither, a soft
Cree
from the spectators at the window outside the courthouse was answered by a loud chorus of
Crows
from the opposite windows, filled with onlookers. Again, The laughter arose everywhere. Even the fair plaintiff herself sat convulsed behind her handkerchief. The figure of Colonel Starbottle alone remained erect, white and rigid. And then the judge, looking up, saw what no one else in the court had seen, that the colonel was sincere and in earnest, that what he had conceived to be the pleader's most perfect acting and most elaborate irony were the deep, serious, mirthless convictions of a man without the least sense of humor. There was a touch of this respect in the judge's voice as he said to him gently, "You may proceed, Colonel Starbottle."
"I thank you, Your Honor," said the colonel slowly, "for recognizing and doing all in your power to prevent an interruption that during my 30 years' experience at the bar I have never yet been subjected to without the privilege of holding the instigators thereof responsible, personally responsible. It is possibly my fault that I have failed, oratorically, to convey to the gentlemen of the jury the full force and significance of the defendant's signals. I am aware that my voice is singularly deficient in producing either the dulcet tones of my fair client or the impassioned vehemence of the defendant's repose. I will," continued the colonel, with a fatigued but blind fatuity that ignored the hurriedly knit brows and warning eyes of the judge, "try again. The note uttered by my client," lowering his voice to the faintest of falsettos, "was,
'Kerree.'
The response was, 'Kerroo.'"
And the colonel's voice fairly shook the dome above him. Another uproar of laughter followed this apparently audacious repetition, but was interrupted by an unlooked-for incident. The defendant rose abruptly, and tearing himself away from the withholding hand and pleading protestations of his counsel, absolutely fled from the courtroom, his appearance outside being recognized by a prolonged "Crow!" from the bystanders, which again and again followed him in the distance. In the momentary silence which followed, the colonel's voice was heard saying,
"We rest here, Your Honor,"
and he sat down. No less white, but more agitated, was the face of the defendant's counsel, who instantly rose.
"For some unexplained reason, Your Honor, my client desires to suspend further proceedings with a view to effect a peaceable compromise with the plaintiff. As he is a man of wealth and position, he is able and willing to pay liberally for that privilege. While I, as his counsel, am still convinced of his legal irresponsibility, as he has chosen, however, to publicly abandon his rights here, I can only ask Your Honor's permission to suspend further proceedings until I can confer with Colonel Starbottle."
"As far as I can follow the pleadings," said the judge gravely, "the case seems to be hardly one for litigation, and I approve of the defendant's course, while I strongly urge the plaintiff to accept it."
Colonel Starbottle bent over his fair client. Presently he rose, unchanged in look or demeanor.
"I yield, Your Honor, to the wishes of my client, and, lady, we accept."
Before the court adjourned that day, it was known throughout the town that Adoniram K. Hotchkiss had compromised the suit for $4,000 and costs. Colonel Starbottle had so far recovered his equanimity as to strut jauntily towards his office, where he was to meet his fair client. He was surprised, however, to find her already there, and in company with a somewhat sheepish-looking young man, a stranger. If the colonel had any disappointment in meeting a third party to the interview, his old-fashioned courtesy did not permit him to show it. He bowed graciously and politely motioned them each to a seat.
"I reckoned I'd bring Hiram round with me," said the young lady, lifting her searching eyes, after a pause, to the colonel's, "though he was awful shy and allowed that you didn't know him from Adam or even suspected his existence. But I said, 'That's just where you slip up, Hiram. A powerful man like the Colonel knows everything, and I've seen it in his eye.
Lordy,
she continued with a laugh, leaning forward over her parasol as her eyes again sought the Colonel's.
Don't you remember when you asked me if I loved that old Hotchkiss? And I told you, that's Stalin, and you looked at me. Lordy, I knew then. You suspected there was a Hiram somewhere. As good as if I told you. Now you just get up, Hiram, and give the Colonel a good handshake. For if it wasn't for him and his searching ways, and his awful power of language, I wouldn't have got that $4,000 out of that flirty fool Hotchkiss, enough to buy a farm, so as you and me could get married. That's what you owe to him. Don't stand there like a stuck fool staring at him. He won't eat you, though he's killed many a better man. Come, have I got to do all the kissing?
It is of record that the Colonel bowed so courteously and so profoundly that he managed not merely to evade the proffered hand of the shy Hiram, but to only lightly touch the franker and more impulsive fingertips of the gentle Zadie.
Offer my sincerest congratulations, though I think you overestimate my powers of penetration. Unfortunately, a pressing engagement, which may oblige me also to leave town tonight, forbids my saying more. I have left the business settlement of this case in the hands of the lawyers who do my office work and who will show you every attention. And now, let me wish you a very good afternoon.
Nevertheless, the Colonel returned to his private room, and it was nearly twilight when the faithful Jim entered, to find him sitting meditatively before his desk.
Oh, God, Colonel, I hope they ain't nothing the matter, but you's looking mighty solemn. I ain't seen you look that way, Colonel, since the day poor Miles Stryker was fetched home, shot through the head. Hand me down the whiskey, Jim,
said the Colonel, rising slowly. The Negro flew to the closet joyfully and brought out the bottle. The Colonel poured out a glass of the spirit and drank it with his old deliberation.
You're quite right, Jim,
he said, putting down his glass.
But I'm getting old, and somehow I'm missing poor Stryker damnably.
My comforter. The world had all gone wrong that day, and tired and in despair, discouraged with the ways of life, I sank into my chair. A soft caress fell on my cheek. My hands were thrust apart, and two big sympathizing eyes gazed down into my heart. I had a friend. What cared I now? For 50 worlds, I knew. One heart was anxious when I grieved. My dog's heart. Loyal, true. God bless him, breathed I soft and low, and hugged him close and tight. One lingering lick upon my ear, and we were happy, quite. Anonymous. The Little White Dog. Little white dog with the meek brown eyes, tell me the boon that you most prize. Would a juicy bone meet your heart's desire? Or a cozy rug by a blazing fire? Or a sudden race with a truant cat? Or a gentle word? Or a friendly pat? Is the worn-out ball you have always near the dearest of all the things held dear? Or is the home you left behind the dream of bliss to your doggish mind? But the little white dog just shook his head, as if, none of these are best, he said. A boy's clear whistle came from the street. There's a wag of the tail and a twinkle of feet. And the little white dog did not even say, excuse me, ma'am, as he scampered away. But I'm sure as can be his greatest joy is just to trot behind that boy. May Ellis Nichols.
just our dog. He was just a dog, mister, that's all. And all of us boys called him Bub. He was curly and not very tall, and he hadn't a tail, just a stub. His tail froze one cold night, you see. We just pulled the rest of him through. No, he didn't have much a pedigree. Perhaps that was frozen off, too. He always seemed quite well behaved, and he never had many bad fights. In summer, he used to be shaved, and he slept in the woodshed o' nights. Sometimes he would wake up too soon and cry if his tail got a chill. Some nights he would bark at the moon, but some nights he would sleep very still. He knew how to play hide and seek, and he always would come when you'd call. He would play dead, roll over, and speak, and learned it in no time at all. Sometimes he would growl, just in play, but he never would bite, and his worst was to bark at the postman one day. But the postman, he barked at him first. He used to chase cats up a tree, but that was just only in fun, and a cat was as safe as could be, unless it should start out to run. Sometimes he'd chase children and throw them down, just while running along, and then lick their faces to show he didn't mean anything wrong. He was chasing an automobile when the wheel hit him right in the side. So he just gave a queer little squeal and curled up and stretched out and died. His tail, it was not very long. He was curly and not very tall. But he never did anything wrong. He was just our dog, mister. That's all. Anonymous. A laugh in church. She sat on the sliding cushion, the dear wee woman of four. Her feet, in their shiny slippers, hung dangling over the floor. She meant to be good, she had promised. And so with her big brown eyes, she stared at the meeting house windows and counted the crawling flies. She looked far up at the preacher, but she thought of the honeybees droning away at the blossoms that whitened the cherry trees. She thought of a broken basket where, curled in a dusky heap, four sleek round puppies with fringy ears lay snuggled and fast asleep. Such soft warm bodies to cuddle, such queer little hearts to beat, such swift round tongues to kiss, such sprawling cushiony feet. She could feel in her clasping fingers the touch of the satiny skin and a cold wet nose exploring the dimples under her chin. Then a sudden ripple of laughter ran over the parted lips, so quick that she could not catch it, with her rosy fingertips. The people whispered, "Bless the child," as each one waked from a nap. But the dear wee woman hid her face for shame in her mother's lap. Anonymous.
Rover Dog. Old Rover Dog, he toasted his toes right by the chimney fire with me. I turned his long ear wrong side out, and he was surprised as he could be. And then he reached right out and took an interest in my lollipop. That's why I shook my finger hard at him, 'cause he just better stop. I asked him which his sweet tooth was, and he just laughed and showed me where. He keeps 'em up and down his mouth. I guess there's most 100 there. He's got a cunning little house, but you can't climb right in and all. Ain't hardly big enough for him. I guess it is a size too small. 'Cause when he is at home, his head stays looking out of his front door. His paws hang out convenient-like, so folks, they will shake hands some more. Old Rover Dog, when he likes folks, he thumps the floor hard with his tail. Where 'tis you've heard that sound before is when your pa, he drives a nail. One time, my Uncle Fred pretend he's tramp man's and will come right in. I put my ear on Rover's back so's I could hear the growl begin. And once it, he thought he'd try his nap right in my grandpa's big armchair. My grandpa, he sat down on him, 'cause he wa'n't spectin' dogs was there. and Rover walked off dignified and curled his back up against the wall. If Grandpa's ain't got manners, why, he isn't going to care at all. That's why I went and explained to him how Grandpa's, they ain't impolite. A Grandpa has the bestest chair because his hair is very white. Then Rover Dog raise up one ear and lift his nose from off his paw and say his feelings aren't all hurt if that was candy that he saw. And when he'd et my chocolate cream, he went and finished up his dream. Marie Louise Tompkins.
Why the dog's nose is cold. What makes the dog's nose always cold? I'll try to tell you, curls of gold, if you will sit upon my knee and very good and quiet be. Well, years and years and years ago, how many I don't really know, there came a rain on sea and shore. Its like was never seen before or since. It fell unceasing down till all the world began to drown. But just before it down did pour, an old, old man, his name was Noah, built him an ark that he might save his family from a watery grave. And in it also he designed to shelter two of every kind of beast. Well, dear, when it was done, and heavy clouds obscured the sun, the Noah folks to it quickly ran, and then the animals began to gravely march along in pairs. The leopards, tigers, wolves, and bears, the deer, the hippopotamuses, the rabbits, squirrels, elks, walruses, the camels, goats, and cats, and donkeys, the tall giraffes, the beavers, monkeys, the rats, the big rhinoceroses, the dromedaries, and the horses, the sheep, the mice, the kangaroos, hyenas, elephants, kudus, and many more, 'twould take all day, my dear, the very names to say. And at the very, very end of the procession by his friend and master faithful dog was seen. The lifelong time he'd helping been to drive the crowd of creatures in. And now, with loud exultant bark, he gaily sprang aboard the bark. Alas, so crowded was the space, he could not in it find a place. So patiently he turned about, stood halfway in, and halfway out, and those extremely heavy showers descended through 900 hours, and more, and darling, at their close, most frozen was his honest nose, and never could it lose again the dampness of that dreadful rain. And that is what my curls of gold made all the doggies' noses cold. Margaret Aitinge. You've been listening to From the Public Domain. I'm your host, Susie Elthens.